Time to take a look at your pet's health. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have you back, Dr. Sandy.
It is so nice to be back.
And you've come with information on a few things that we need to talk about before we take calls here. Tail docking.
Yeah, there was a study that was done in Great Britain, and that is a country where since 2007, tail docking has been banned. Tail docking along with ear cropping is something that, you know, there are certain standards for many breeds that, and if you want to show them, they expect that you're going to have, you know, shorter tails. And so they're usually amputated in little puppies when they're 2 or 3 days of age. And when you ask people that are pro tail dockers why it's done, you know, besides just appearance of the animal, which you start wondering, why are we doing this for cosmetics?
Right.
They say it helps prevent tail injuries because a lot of these dogs that have the shorter tails are field dogs and working dogs. Although I haven't seen too many Cocker Spaniels be able to do much hunting. I think that's kind of been bred out of most of them. But what they did was they looked at about 140,000 dogs and kept track of them for over a year to see how many dogs actually experienced tail injuries. And of those, there was 281 tail injuries. Most of those actually occurred in greyhounds, lurchers, and whippets, which are not dogs that we dock tails on because they have those long, skinny, whippy tails. And it's usually from hitting the wall or getting caught in a door, that type of thing. And so what the results of this were is that, you know, tail docking, you'd have to dock about 500 dogs to save one injury. Yeah, it's, you know, it comes back to, no, you can't use that as a reason for, yeah, for continuing to do it. So I hope that one of these years our country will get on the ball and join Great Britain and stop doing this unnecessary surgery.
Another study had to do with litter odor control additives.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when you're at the pet store or in the grocery store buying litters, you'll see all these things like, you know, with activated carbon in it to help control urine odor or litter odor. And some of them will have bicarbonate of soda in it, baking soda-based litters. So they decided, let's see what the cat likes. And so they gave all these litter boxes to cats and gave it a try. And it turned out that cats seem to enjoy the carbon-enhanced litter better, that they use that much more frequently. And so that's, you know, probably with cats having a sensitive nose, the thought was that perhaps they prefer that because it controls odor better. They can't, the box doesn't get as stinky as fast. So, you know, from the human standpoint, I think either one works, but that's the one the cats prefer. So you may want to be looking for litters that have the carbon-based odor control.
And you shouldn't be giving your dogs bones as treats.
Well, veterinarians have been saying this forever, that, you know, avoid natural bones because they splinter and they can break teeth and act as foreign bodies, you know, in, not only in the esophagus, but coming out the other end, too. We've taken had a lot of dogs where we've had to remove bone fragments and so on. But now the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is also putting out a consumer warning regarding this as well. So we even have some backup from the authorities. It's not just the veterinarian saying this anymore. And, you know, and this is, again, one of those things we'll talk about later in the show about the salmonella issues with pet food. But, you know, bones coming from animals, you have to be aware that they may be carrying E. coli and salmonella, too.
Let's take some calls. Dawn in Lake Mills is up with a question. Dawn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I've got a little Brussels Griffon poodle mix, and he's got a lot of eye discharge, and it's staining, and it's kind of smelly.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, is the Angel Eyes product safe to give to dogs?
The what product? I'm sorry.
Angel Eyes.
Angel Eyes?
Okay. Tear staining.
Yeah. Well, what that tear staining is when you have dogs, especially dogs that have either protruding eyes or a lot of hair around their face that collects tears or irritates the eyes a little bit, the tears will start accumulating, running down the face and get into those face folds. And tears contain a chemical called porphyrins, which are natural, but when they react to light, they turn that kind of rusty brown color. And so number one thing to do, I mean, yes, that product that you're mentioning is going to help with bleaching the hair a little bit. You don't want to get it in the eyes. There's a number of products out there. One that I've personally used is called Eye Envy. I've bought it at a cat show and use it on my dogs, though, because my dogs have face folds and they have the same problem with some face staining. But keep the hair trim short. That's the number one thing. And have your veterinarian look for things like plugged tear ducts, extra eyelashes that may be irritating the eye and causing increased tearing, and, you know, kind of forego the poofy-faced dog and go for a clean-cut look that's going to allow you to keep it cleaner. And that's the reason why it gets a little stinky like that, is you get a little dermatitis underneath that wet hair. And so having that checked to make sure that you don't have a skin infection or a yeast infection, bacterial infection or yeast infection, and treat those appropriately if necessary.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in Grant County, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Thank you so much. I have a couple questions. I'm wondering if it's possible to cover more things that have to do with birds, from smaller birds to the larger birds?
Well, that's a really good question. And even though I'm a bird lover, I have an Illiger's macaw at home who his name is Sydney, and he doesn't have an upper beak. I paid for his hospitalization and ended up adopting him. He was a victim of a bird fight. And I have a Nande conure. So I'm comfortable with my own birds. But in the veterinary world, things have become so specialized that from my point of view, I may be able to answer some simple questions regarding bird behavior and bird health, but it has become, they are such a different species than the mammalian species that we're dealing with. They have a whole host of different health problems and nutritional needs and housing needs that I've kind of tried to, shy away from doing
those.
That if I could. It would be kind of like asking me a question about a cow, okay? I drink milk and once in a while, don't tell my daughter, eat some beef. But I'm definitely not qualified to be able to answer questions regarding large animals either. So that's kind of why the show has been more based on dogs and cats. But if you do have a question, I'd be glad to try to answer it or be able to refer you to somebody that may be able to answer it for you.
Well, I do have a question. My question is I have a parakeet, and do you know very much about the molting seasons?
I don't. I know that it happens. It's based primarily on light. And so if the bird is housed in artificial light, that can adjust molting seasons. If your bird is losing an abnormal amount of feathers, maybe is feather plucking like some birds do. I've never seen that in a parakeet. But some birds will feather pick themselves and pull feathers out. That has nothing to do with molting. And that is something that we believe is probably more of a behavioral issue, but there could be some medical basis for it as well. So if your bird is experiencing an abnormal loss of feathers, time to take him in and be seen by an avian specialist, not me.
I guess I was wondering, are there some food types of things that should be more attention being paid to during molting?
Yeah, I don't know. Any time that we're feeding birds, the big concern that I have is when you walk through the pet store, you see most of the diets are going to be seed-based diets. And when you look at birds in the wild, seed makes up a very small part of their diet, and it can be extremely unbalanced. And so you can get birds that become sunflower addicted, and all they want to do is eat that, and they're very high in fat, and not going to be giving them the nutritional needs that they require. So, my birds eat, this morning they had corn. They do love a little teeny tiny piece of cheese once in a while. And one of my birds, he asks for it. So yeah, that's what he likes. They had grapes and strawberries and some black beans. They did get a little bit of seed. I actually make a bird bread for them that is from a mix that you can make and bake, kind of these little muffiny type things. So that's what I do for my birds. But with your bird, I'm not sure what you're feeding, but they should be on a good, well-balanced diet. And an avian veterinarian would be able to assess the diet. That's part of your bird's evaluation, is not only looking at its overall health, but also assessing its nutrition as well.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. And we'll turn to Mark in Brookfield next. Mark, hello.
Hello. Great show. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I have a question about a 9-month-old Labrador.
Okay.
And we're really concerned because she's got some food aggression issues, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
when we feed her and stuff, she doesn't normally, but once in a while she'll growl, and I'm wondering what the best proceed steps to take are.
Yeah, I mean, this can be, this is obviously a behavioral issue, and unless, I mean, I obviously always want to assess to make sure that there's nothing painful or anything going on. Being a lab, being a long-legged dog, if they're experiencing any neck pain or limb pain, if the bowls are on the floor, elevating them a little bit. They do make elevated feeding dishes. Sometimes that can make the dog more comfortable, but that would be really unlikely. My guess is that the dog is just challenging you, saying, you know, this is my food. You can't come near it. I'm the only one with the dog bowl here. Whenever we're dealing with something like that, I think you need to kind of look at the pet's kind of life as a whole. And there's two things that I like owners to remember. Nothing in life is free, and four on the floor. And those are two little easy sayings, but what that basically is saying is that food just doesn't come for free. We have to work to be able to buy dog food. What is she doing to be able to get her food? So working on your obedience where she learns to sit and wait, and then she may have her dinner, but she has to do something for you. It's not just like, hey, you know, feed me now. And that's true for anything. If she wants to go outside, if she wants to be petted, you know, where she is not coming up and making demands of you. You are asking something of her before she gets something that she wants. The four on the floor business is giving you priority access to the best resting areas. So you're on the sofa, she's not. She's got a comfortable resting area on the floor, because sometimes we'll see, you know, things like that where the dog starts feeling like, you know, I can get away with this if, you know, my, you know, dad has to sit on the floor because I've taken over the sofa. And that puts me in a higher, higher position of authority. So, you know, a couple of things to work on that way. But, you know, I always am hesitant to recommend people doing things like putting their hands in the food bowl or, you know, taking the food away, because that's just going to end up getting you bit. So be working on maybe multiple small meals a day where you're getting her to work for her dinner. And so she starts learning that the only way I get to eat and who controls the food are the humans.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Barbara in Rice Lake, on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a small terrier mix. He's about 3 years old and came from the pound. We've had him for about 2 years. In the summer, he started shedding toenails.
Oh. Huh. Yeah. Huh.
The first one that came off was chair versus dog, so that was
okay. Understandable. Okay.
It snapped off and came off fairly cleanly. But since then, he's lost four more.
Oh, my goodness.
And one, you know, a couple of them, we didn't even know he lost until we went to trim nails and discovered, oh, he's missing
broken.
Another one.
Yeah. A fairly common condition that we see in dogs, which, first of all, make sure that there is, you know, nothing going on grooming-wise, that you are keeping the nails short, that they're not allowed to get overly long where they can get caught on things, because that's obviously probably the number one reason why dogs will break a nail,
right. Is not having
them groomed.
Challenging at this point because he has broken a few off and they've been painful.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it takes two of us and...
Yeah.
It's more challenging now.
Yeah. It's funny. In the last year or so, I've had a handful of cases in, not just me, but other people in the clinic. And I don't know why we've had a run on this condition, but there is an immune condition that affects the nails that makes them more brittle. And it's called lupoid onychodystrophy. Big name, but it's like a brittle nail syndrome in dogs. And it's something that we treat as an immune-mediated disease. Many of these dogs will go on niacinamide. We'll put them on doxycycline, which is an antibiotic, but it also is an immune-modulating drug as well, and make sure that the nails that are there are trimmed back as short as possible. And so, you know, very frequent, every couple of weeks, going in for a professional nail trim from your veterinarian, and they may even have to grind the nails down a little bit, and just keeping those nails nice and short. So as the medication is working, the nails become, you know, more stable, and you can avoid having them fracture. So that would be something I would talk to your veterinarian about. Is it this immune problem called lupoid onychodystrophy? Big name. Don't ask me to spell it.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take more of your calls as we talk your pet's health with Dr. Sandy at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on the air. We have an email from Kay and Caroline. As a beagle, had surgery to remove fatty tumors. Are there any treatments or diets that can reduce these tumors?
No. What these tumors are called lipomas, and they're a benign tumor. I'll stop there just for a second. There is a very uncommon form of a malignant fat tumor called a liposarcoma or an infiltrative lipoma, which reacts very differently. But they are extremely common in dogs, and almost every dog as they get older is going to develop these little fatty masses. And for the most part, they're cosmetic. People get them, and dogs get them if they're in a spot that is not bothering the dog, such as, over their shoulder or on their side or whatever. We don't usually worry about them. The last two cases that I've actually referred to our surgery department to have lipomas removed, one was a guide dog who had a lipoma right under his harness, and so it was irritating to him. And the other dog was a field dog that had one on his sternum, and every time he laid down, and he would always be laying down out in the field and in the woods, he would irritate this mass that was like a big tennis ball size on his sternum. So we removed that one. There's nothing you can do nutritionally. It's just happens. Yeah. And I wish there was a good, easy fix for it, but dogs that are prone to get them are probably going to get others. But just be careful. There are some other tumors that just because your dog has been diagnosed with lipomas, don't think that every lump and bump that comes up is a lipoma. We had a Cocker Spaniel in not too long ago that had 13 new masses. All of my patients that have skin bumps, we keep a body map in the record, and we give a copy to the owners so that when new bumps come up, we can get them logged in and checked to confirm what they are. We went through systematically and checked every one of these lumps, and lucky number 13 turned out to be a malignant tumor called a mast cell tumor. It felt exactly like a lipoma. It was in a location that we would expect to see a lipoma, but it turned out to be something that needed to be treated much more aggressively.
Oh.
So you always want to have these things checked and charted, and not necessary to actually have them removed. And in fact, if you put your dog on a diet, people will ask, if I diet my dog, because a lot of beagles are a little overweight, are the lipomas going to shrink? No, they do not respond to metabolism. So whatever, your dog can get nice and thin and normal, those masses are going to stay the same.
Let's turn to Barbara in Neenah, Wisconsin. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. A mother cat showed up with four kittens about a week ago. We live out in the country. And then she took off 2 days later with three kittens and left us with one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've fallen in love.
Okay.
And I just wondered, what do we do to, I've been feeding it and giving it water, and it kind of stays under our deck and doesn't quite let me touch it yet, but it's getting close.
Good.
I don't know. It's about the size of my hand.
So, and that's when you've got cats that are being raised in the wild or outdoors, it's sometimes hard to age them by looking at size because they can be runty if they're parasitized or have infectious diseases. They may not grow as a normal house-raised kitten would grow. But there are ways that we can determine what the age is, but you would have to have the cat to be able to hold on to it. It's usually we look at their teeth as their baby teeth are falling out and their permanent teeth are coming in. The real critical time for socializing kitties is in the first 2 to 7 weeks of age. That is so critical for that early handling is going to make a cat much more likely to want to be a lap cat and be around people. If you can, I don't know how old this kitty is, but you're kind of sitting on a ticking clock here. And the earlier that you can get this cat, handled nicely and have it learn to trust you, you'll probably be able to turn it into a nice house pet. And I think that if you fall in love with this cat, it does need veterinary care and should get started on deworming and vaccinations and checking for infectious diseases like feline leukemia and FIV. It's a simple blood test that your veterinarian could run. They can determine the sex of the kitty for you and talk about spaying and neutering so that we don't perpetuate this problem with having more cats in the wild. Good luck with your kitty.
Good luck. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Nice little kitty as a pet. Good. Ed in Camp Lake. On to you. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Sawchuk, I have a question. I have an elderly cat that's 18 years old that I adopted about a year ago from its previous owner.
Oh, nice of you to do that. Yeah.
He was diagnosed with chronic renal failure.
Okay.
Now, I've done a lot of reading, and this was diagnosed about 4 years ago when he went in to have a routine dental cleaning done, and they did not do the cleaning because he won't tolerate the anesthetic.
Okay.
And he, of course, needs a cleaning terribly, and his breath is rather bad because of it. And I'm wondering, A, is there something I can do to help the situation? And B, I feed him strictly a diet of canned food, and okay. He does not particularly like the good quality canned foods. He wants the cheap stuff.
Okay.
And he eats about a can and a half of food a day. And I'm wondering if I can give him a little dry food or if he must always have canned food.
Well, I'm going to, first of all, while I'm thinking of it, just refer you to an excellent website. And anybody that has a cat that's been diagnosed with kidney disease, it's called Feline CRF, Chronic Renal Failure, felinecrf.com. Excellent site that goes through all the medical management, and you know, the different drugs that we can use, fluid therapy, diets, and so on. The big important thing nutritionally for cats with renal disease is that they do much better on a kidney-friendly diet, which tends to have lower phosphorus, higher potassium levels. It tends to be a little bit lower in protein. You have to be careful with cats because they are carnivores, so you don't want to protein restrict them like we do dogs. And water, water, water. Keep them well hydrated. Canned food's going to provide more water. But, you know, the question I have, too, is if your cat's got a really bad mouth, giving them dry food is going to be painful for them to eat. And so that that could be a problem for the cat. And you don't want to have this cat starve itself by saying, I don't want to eat this food, or I'm afraid to eat now because when I put stuff in my mouth, it hurts. If the cat has really bad breath, and if you've not taken the kitty into a veterinarian to have it reassessed, I think that it's really important to do so because there's other things besides dental disease that can cause the cat to have bad breath. Things like oral masses can do that, and an 18-year-old cat could have a tumor in its mouth that makes chewing uncomfortable. Sometimes cats, as their kidney disease progresses, can get ulcers in their mouth, and they can feel pretty uncomfortable with those as well, and it can produce a pretty nasty odor from their mouth. So time to go in, reassess that lab work. We do dentals in cats with chronic renal disease at the veterinary school. I'm not going to say frequently, but often enough if it's a quality of life type thing. The big things to be paying attention to are blood pressure, fluid administration, make sure that the cat is being monitored, you know, very carefully during anesthesia. But in general, it can be a safe procedure if you watch fluid balance and don't allow the cat to become dehydrated during the procedure.
All right.
Okay, well, that sure does help because he's lost some weight over the last 4 years. He went from 10 pounds to 8.6.
Okay.
And that was last year about this time. And I'm feeling he's probably lost a little bit more, but he does seem to be happy and doing well.
Good.
And
good.
My vet would like to do the lab work again because obviously now it's been about 4 years.
Yep.
And I was flipping a coin thinking to myself, is it really worth it?
Well, you know? I think it really is because there are things that we can do to improve your cat's quality of life. Simple things like adding in a potassium supplement may increase his appetite. Sometimes adding in phosphate binders if they have a problem with their calcium and phosphorus, which can happen with kidney disease. So there's medications that can be used, some of them more palatable than others. Blood pressure evaluation is critical in these cats as well. And the fact that he's continuing to lose weight, don't rule out the fact that he could have another disease going on. We'll see many cats have, at the same time, chronic renal failure along with hyperthyroidism, and that can make a cat be eating and playful and yet losing weight. So have him screened. When you go in for lab work, make sure you're also getting a thyroid screen done as well.
And thank you very much for calling.
Thank you very much.
Al in Two Harbors, on to you now. Hi, Al.
Hi. I've got a 10-and-a-half-year-old Great Pyrenees who is generally in very good health, but he's getting a little stiff and sometimes needs help jumping into the pickup truck. And I've been giving him in the last month one aspirin a day, which is 325 milligrams of just regular aspirin. And it has made a lot of difference. He's a lot more active and can easily jump in the truck now. But I'm wondering, is there any long-term harm to doing this?
Yeah, you know, Great Pyrenees is a large breed dog, and as a 10-and-a-half-year-old dog, they're definitely a senior, and it's very common for senior dogs to develop some joint issues where they become a little stiff and sore. And, hey, I'm in my 50s, and I you know, sometimes after a big, heavy day of exercise, I feel it the next day as well. One of my big concerns is the fact that you're using aspirin. I'm not going to get into dosages and so on the radio, but you have to be extremely careful with using human medications in dogs. Aspirin is extremely irritating to the stomach. Many dogs do develop gastric ulcers from it, and there are safer non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that you could use that you can get from your veterinarian or via prescription online if that you prefer to go that way as well, but you would need a prescription. Anytime we're using a long-term non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which is aspirin falls in that category as well, we want to be monitoring liver values. We want to be monitoring kidney values to make sure that we don't have underlying kidney disease, which can be made worse by using some of these drugs. So I think it's time, rather than self-medicating, time to go to your veterinarian and say, you know, what can we do? And they may make some other suggestions, too, regarding using some joint supplements like glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate may be helpful. Some joint diets, which are higher in antioxidants and fatty acids and so on, they're quite helpful as well. So there's lots of things that can be done. But at this point, I'd say really watch the aspirin. Even though your dog's doing better, long term, you could be causing your dog more harm than good.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Minocqua has a dog recently diagnosed with and treated for an anaplasmosis.
Mm-hmm.
Is this disease becoming a near epidemic? Our emailer wonders.
Oh, well, we're seeing lots of it in this area as well. Anaplasmosis is one of these tick-borne diseases that is spread by the same family of ticks that carries Lyme disease. And so we see a lot of dogs with co-infections, not only anaplasmosis, but also Lyme disease as well. And when we get a positive back on a dog, when we do our little test kit, it's typically done on an annual basis along with the heartworm check. If they come back positive, things that we want to be monitoring are primarily looking for low numbers of platelets and white blood cells. So we usually do a blood cell count on the dog to see if we've got any problems going on. Great majority of dogs, though, can have silent infections, which are just, you know, they don't show any sign of illness. But things you'd want to be looking for are lack of energy, a fever, loss of appetite, vomiting and diarrhea. And they can even have, just like dogs with Lyme disease, swollen, painful joints as well. But the difference with anaplasma is that it does affect the bone marrow. So monitoring CBC, probably if it's normal, at least on an annual basis to make sure that the dog isn't developing clinical anaplasma.
Virginia in Whitehall, on to you now. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I just wanted to see if Dr. Sawchuk had some opinions here on our 4-year-old female boxer, who is normally a very energetic, happy-go-lucky dog, and she's exhibiting some other symptoms now that have us very concerned.
Mm-hmm. What's she doing?
Well, she, late last week, she started sneezing. Didn't think anything about it, except one time I heard her sneezing 4 times in a row, you know, sort of like we do every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this is not normal for her, and I was aware of her sneezing more often. Now, what really has me concerned is she's very lethargic acting
mm-hmm.
when she's in the house. But if she goes outside, then she's like happy, kind of, you know, I think she tries to because that she likes that and she's happy doing that. But inside, she is drowsy. And what has me most concerned is she is now sitting there with her mouth. I can see in the very front, it's like there's a 1/2 inch to a 3/4 inch opening. Her mouth, it's almost like she's breathing through
her mouth. Yeah. Yeah, anytime you've got a change in dog's behavior, and like you're describing, it's time to be seen by somebody. And things that I would be concerned about, to give you an example, we had a dog in last week. I was on vacation, but one of my colleagues saw it, and it was actually a colleague at the veterinary school who has a golden retriever that likes to eat mulch and chew on mulch and probably, you know, inhaled or did something and ended up getting a chunk of mulch up in her nasal cavity and just came in sneezing. And they found it and we were able to get it out of there. I'm not saying that that's what's not going on with your dog, but being a boxer who is experiencing some sneezing and is now apparently having some difficulty, you know, that's at least what you're observing, uh-huh. getting air through the nostrils. Uh-huh. We worry about things like foreign bodies, nasal tumors, inflammatory diseases affecting the nose, infections, and so on. And first thing the veterinarian can do is do some simple tests to see if air is moving through the nostrils. You can, you know, hold a little thread up to the nostril and see if the air, it moves the air. You can fog a glass slide and just see if you're getting good airflow through. But a good exam, now that's tough to look up a dog's nose. They, you know, to be able to see anything beyond, you know, just the first like little quarter inch or so up the nostril, it involves anesthesia and scoping, a CT scan potentially of the skull. But, you know, that might be the way to go if they determine that, yes, your dog does have some type of upper respiratory obstruction.
We do have an appointment this afternoon, but good. At the same time, I just wanted to see if you had an opinion on it. She has been on thyroid medication as well.
Yeah.
Two pills a day.
And I was going to, you know, say that for a boxer that's slowing down and not being quite as active and playful, ruling out hyperthyroidism, and you may want to just double check to make sure her dose is at the appropriate level for her. It sometimes changes as dogs age and so on.
They may need... and as we do as people.
Right. Yeah. And then the other thing that's very common in boxers is they do get cardiomyopathy, heart disease. Mm. And so having a good listen to your dog's heart, often they don't show, you know, signs except for being, you know, exercise intolerance will be the first thing that we see and just being more tired than normal. So a good listen to the dog's heart, perhaps, you know, feeling pulses, getting an EKG if they feel anything abnormal, chest x-rays. But you may be in for a little bit of a workup here with your puppy. Good luck. Everything I've told you doesn't sound like good news. And I hope that you do find good news.
Thank you again for calling.
About dog food, reading the ingredients, mm-hmm. which is better? Because most of them begin with corn. Would it be better to buy the one that begins with meat, the first ingredient?
Well, that's a really good question. And the big things that I like to have people look for on a pet food label is not necessarily the ingredients, but I want to see a symbol that says that it has gone through AFCO testing, American Association of Feed Control Officials, not just that it meets AFCO standards, but that it's actually gone through AFCO testing. It's actually been fed to dogs. Believe it or not, there are dog foods out there that have never gone through testing. They just manufacture it, put it in bags and sell it, and it's good luck consumer. So that's probably one of the most important things on the label. When it comes to order that you place ingredients on a label, it's based on weight. And so if you're using wet meat, then it's obviously going to weigh more because it's got more water in it. And so that's going to move that ingredient up higher on the list of ingredients. When you're using meat meal, which is doesn't contain beaks, feathers, hooves, intestinal contents, you know, anything like that, no hair, it's all, you know, it's meat that perhaps is not going to be suitable for human consumption because we just don't like it. It doesn't mean that it's not nutritious, as made into meal and then put in the food. That particular ingredient, because it's dry, is going to be down lower on the list. So you really have to be able to know what's the moisture content of the ingredient that's going in there. And so you can, manufacturers can futz with labels a little bit by changing how the ingredients are inserted into the food. It doesn't mean the ingredients are any different. It just means moisture content. Mm-hmm. So be careful about how you assess pet food.
And while we're on the subject of food, and Virginia, thank you, by the way, for calling. There have been food recalls, another whole batch of them.
Yeah, it started out not too long ago with the Iams company, all of their professional diets, where their therapeutic diets got recalled. And this is not because there's been any illness associated with them. It was totally precautionary. And this is something that consumers in general just need to be aware of, is that back 3 years ago when we had that melamine scare and that really increased not only the consumers, but the manufacturers of pet food, their vigilance of, you know, with manufacturing and monitoring. And they have even come up with an early detection reporting system now that's the reportable food registry. So if a manufacturer has some even minor concern, it gets reported, it gets out to the consumer before we start seeing any indications of health, not only in pets, but in humans as well. The big one that has been concern is salmonella. And this is nothing new. I mean, back before this was even reported, there was a study that came out of Pediatric Journal that found that there were 79 cases in children of salmonella exposure from pet food in 2006 to 2008. So yeah, this is back several years ago. Anytime pet food is in a home, whether it's treats or food, because it contains animal products, you have to assume that it can contain salmonella and E. coli. And it's just important for consumers to keep children away from food bowls, not have pets fed in areas where food's being prepared, washing your hands after handling food and treats. And this is especially important for young people, young children, elderly people, and people with immune-mediated diseases or any immune suppression, that they be careful with handling pet food. And, you know, this is a big setback for IMS, but it's not an indication of you know, it's just part of pet food manufacturing. You're going to have that, just like it is in human food.
Lizzie in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi. I have a 4-year-old cat. He's an indoor one.
Okay.
And sometimes we let him outside because, you know, walk around because he gets cooped up in the house. But when he gets outside, he starts to mow down on some grass.
Mm-hmm.
And these are long pieces of grass. And probably after 5 minutes of him going on a small binge, mm-hmm. he pukes them up.
Yeah.
And this has been happening probably the last maybe 3 or 4 times that we've let him out.
Yeah.
And we're not sure what it is, because when he pukes up, it's like we don't know if it's he has a hairball problem or if it's the food.
Well, these are really good questions. It's probably neither. Some cats just like a salad now and then. My favorite photo that I have of my pets that are, you know, I have a tortoise and dogs and a cat, where when my daughter was young, we had a slide in the backyard, and the grass, because the water would run down the slide, would always grow longer right there. And that was the favorite spot for whenever anybody went outside. They'd head right to the slide, base of the slide, and eat the grass and chow down on the grass. I have a picture of my cat, my dog, and my tortoise all eating simultaneously. The only one that is a vegetarian is the tortoise. And so, you know, we know that some cats just like to eat grass, as dogs do. They like the taste of it. They like to have, you know, it's chewy, whatever. Some will do it as a purgative if they know that it'll make them vomit. But if your cat is indoors, feeling great, no vomiting inside, eating well, normal stool, then my guess is that it's just the cat isn't that smart, goes out, likes grass, but then it's a little irritating and up it comes. So unless it's a, you know, you're seeing other symptoms of illness to make your cat want to go out and eat grass, then I'd say, you know, don't worry about it. But just be careful around with pesticides or herbicides that could be on the grass. You want to make sure you're avoiding contact with those, especially if your cat's ingesting it.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Tim in La Crosse up next with a question. So let's go to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I got a question. My 9-year-old black lab seems to be in really good health. He's starting to get a little older, moving a little slower. But the hair on the side of his tails is wearing off.
Ah. Huh. Couple things I'd think about. We talked with one of the callers just recently about hypothyroidism, where the thyroid gland is not producing enough thyroid hormone. And sometimes we will see symmetrical hair loss, sometimes starting on the tail, maybe spreading up the sides. And because the tail gets a lot of wear when the dog's sitting down, that's one of the first spots that we may see it. So if, you know, especially if your dog is carrying a little extra weight and slowing down a little bit, that would be one thing that would be an easy enough thing to have checked, is it's a blood sample to check thyroid function. And it may just be that it's just kind of an age-related thing. If your dog is spending more time sitting down, not moving as much, maybe it's the tail's a little stiff so they can't, you know, wrap it around themselves. And dogs can get arthritis in their tail. We can see hair loss in areas that are just getting a little more worn, kind of like the dog's elbows and hocks, where you'll see those calluses building up. And it's, you know, same thing. It's just because they're getting constant contact and just getting irritated. So, but rule out a thyroid problem. And then, you know, if they don't find anything, maybe nothing. It may just be cosmetic.
All right.
Yeah, I did have that test run a couple months ago. And he had a dog door on his doghouse.
Okay.
That I thought was maybe, you know, scraping on his tail.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that off, and that didn't seem to help. And the one thing I'm just kind of thinking about is, with hunting season, he does do a lot of hunting. Is that going to be a problem, him not having the hair on his tail or the warmth?
Yeah, I don't think the warmth is going to be that big of a deal. The tail having very little muscle tissue around it and so on. You know, it's always going to be a problem with keeping tails warm. But, you know, even we'll see dogs with, like, you know, much shorter hair hunting just fine with tails, so, and not having trouble with that. So I don't think it's going to be a problem. But, you know, I'd be just watching. If it's only been in the last couple of months, you may be going through a hair growth phase in a little bit where they're going to shed and get new hair coat. And when that happens, you may find that the hair in his tail grows right back in if it's all due to an environmental problem like the dog door.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And Donna in Lake Geneva, we turn to you now. Hi, Donna.
Hi. We live on a small farm. We just moved there 3 years ago, and we have gotten a collection of barn cats that we've been catching and neutering. One of the cats is a really, really sweet guy, and he was being kind of beaten by the other one. So mm-hmm. He has come into the house. He's actually living in the greenhouse right now because last fall I took him into the vet. He was 5 weeks old.
Okay.
Kitten. Now this kitten has grown up to be just a huge cat. He just got neutered a couple months ago. My problem is I would love to introduce them. And the kitten lives with a cat that came with the house.
Mm-hmm.
Spayed female. The spayed female and the kitten are the most timid cats. They play and they're wonderful with my husband and me, but you get them near a stranger and you would think that going to cut their heads off.
Right. And, you know, so much of it is just socialization early on. And this came up earlier in the show that it's important for cats to not only be socialized with people really young in life, in those first like 7 weeks of life, but also to be around other cats so that they are comfortable and know how to interact with other cats appropriately and they have appropriate social skills. And it's not just socializing to you and your husband, it's socializing to lots of different people. I, too, have a cat like this at home, and people don't believe me when I say I have three cats. They say, you only have one. We only see one. And I have one that will, with time, come up, but there's another one that if there's anybody new in the house, she does not even show her head. I mean, she could be days hiding, and she'll only come out and eat at night and use the litter box and be hiding someplace in my office or whatever. But accept him as he is. You're already at a point where he's a young adult, and to change that might be a little difficult. But when you do have people over, make sure that you're not carrying him out and forcing the issue that, you know, you're going to meet these people. Let him do it on his terms. Tell the people ahead of time, don't look at him, don't reach for him, and just give him some treats that they can toss towards the cat. And perhaps with time, he'll get a few more people that he likes and will be a little braver around some of your friends.
Well, my second part of the question was, do you think that I could introduce this? He was a tomcat, the cat that is living in the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we bring him into the house when the other cats are in another area of the house. We bring him into our bedroom, and he's the sweetest cat. And I think he may have been a house cat.
Yeah, and whenever we're introducing new cats into an environment that has existing cats, you want to go about it slowly. I call it dating, okay? Let them get used to each other's odors, the sight of each other, where perhaps with a, you know, through a glass door or whatever, so that you don't want to throw a cat in and have them start fighting, because it's very difficult to backstep from that point. So you want to go about it slowly, make sure that you're increasing the number of resources that are there, feeding stations, litter boxes, and so on appropriately. You know, just be smart about it, too. The more cats you have, the greater chance that you are going to have some social problems. And I had a woman in yesterday that has five cats in her house, and one of them is a chronic sprayer. And, you know, and that's it's because she's not only got five cats in her home, but she's got a couple of neighbor cats that come and sit on the deck and torment her cats. And this poor little cat is just very socially stressed, and that's what happens. So you have to prepare yourself with more cats. You might be running into some issues that way. So, yeah.
Good luck.
Go slow. Yeah.
Go slow. Nancy in Shorewood, on to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. I have a 5-month-old kitten, Ragdoll, and the breeder recommend not getting a feline leukemia vaccine. If I take her outside, she's supervised, but I do take in where I babysit some friends' cats. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm a little gun-shy because my parents had a volunteer cat show up at their farm who, of course, became a house cat and has now been diagnosed with feline leukemia. So
yeah.
They are devastated. So, I mean, I know there's sometimes risks involved with the vaccine, but I don't know the pros and cons.
Okay.
Give me any information.
Yeah. The American Association of Feline Practitioners comes out periodically with updated guidelines of vaccines. And I do recommend that as a pet owner, that would be something that you could refer to. You can go to the American Association of Feline Practitioners website, and I can't remember what it is. It's catvetsomething.org, so I don't know what it is. But and they have that all listed there. Feline leukemia vaccine is currently not what's considered a core vaccine, meaning that not every cat needs it. But some, they're starting to look at it as an important vaccine and probably should be a core vaccine for cats, young cats, in the first year or two of life to be vaccinated with it. Because that's the time, if they are going to pick up the disease, that's when they're going to get it. It's much easier to infect a young cat and very, very difficult, if not impossible, to infect an older cat. So, you know, the big risk time is right now. If your cat is not exposed to other cats, preferably not going outside or outdoors with 100% supervision, then it's probably okay to not vaccinate. But if you're bringing other cats in, I would strongly recommend that you do vaccinate unless you know the current status on every cat that's coming into the house. So if I was in this situation with my beloved cat and I was going to be babysitting other cats, I would want to see current feline leukemia and FIV status on the cats, especially if they are indoor-outdoor cats, where their status could change at any time if they get into a fight or have exposure to stray cats. And then when it comes to vaccines, there's a couple of different types of feline leukemia vaccine on the market. The one that we're using at the veterinary school, which is a transdermal vaccine. It's called it's made by the Mariel company. It's called PureVax, feline leukemia vaccine. Appears to be a little safer from the standpoint of less irritation at the injection site than the other injectable vaccines. So you may want to talk to your veterinarian as to what type of feline leukemia vaccine they're using if you're concerned about injection site reactions.
Mm-hmm. And just the website for the American Association of Feline Veterinarians is catvets.com.
There it is. I knew I was close. Okay, yes. And on that site, they do have the vaccine guidelines that anyone can look at.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Nancy. We had a question from Patricia, who's been battling scabies, mange on her chocolate lab for some time. She said, I also contracted the little buggers, but I was easy to treat. We've been using Primaris and HeartGuard, plus I've been using an aloe oatmeal shampoo. Is there a better treatment?
Yeah. Scabies is a skin mite that it can be it's very contagious and it can affect people. So I'd be looking at, you know, are there other pets in the environment that may need to be treated as well? I'm not aware that Promaris is labeled for treating scabies. Promaris is a spot-on flea and tick product made by the Fort Dodge Company, and there's some thought that it may get a mite called Demodex, but I'm not aware of it being labeled for scabies. There is a topical broad-spectrum heartworm preventative called Revolution that can have some effect against scabies, but we do see even failures with that at times. Typically, the way we treat scabies is using a lime sulfur dip. It's a mess to use. It smells like kind of a rotten eggs. Larry's been through it because we also use it for treating ringworm, and he adopted a kitty from the Humane Society that had been in the past treated for ringworm and still came with a little residual odor. So it is something that's pretty stinky, but you know, we do that. We dip them a couple of times a week, and usually after about 6 weeks or so, we can clear the little bugs from the pets. So good luck.
And what about, she's read some things about using borax and peroxide.
Ooh, you know, borax is something that we use in our laundry. I would not be applying it topically if the dog were to lick it. They'd have to eat, you know, quite a bit of it to be toxic, but it can be toxic. So, you know, these over-the-counter things, and if your dog has irritated skin, pouring peroxide on skin that is irritated is not going to be pleasant for the dog either. So go with something different and talk to your veterinarian about using the lime sulfur dips.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Join us with your questions about your cat's health or your dog's health at 1-800-642-1234. Email talk at WPR.org. And Sandy, we had an email from Dan in Verona. They have an 8-year-old tabby cat. In the past year, he started shaking when he purrs and making gulping or swallowing noises.
Huh.
We've only noticed this when he purrs. He had a CAT scan, to look for nasal polyps, and it came back totally clean. Our vet does not know what else it could be.
Wow, very strange. And I think that the vet's right on the ball. That would be the first thing that I would think of is some type of obstructive type problem. And cats are prone to getting these benign polyps that sit kind of in the back of the nasal passages and can even grow out through the ear, the eustachian tube, and so on. So you've already evaluated for that. I don't know if they actually went down into the trachea and had a scoped the main airway, but that would be the other thing that would be, do we have something obstructive there? Although I would expect the cat to probably be coughing or having some other respiratory distress at other times rather than just purring. So I don't know. I'd have to see the patient and actually see them do this. And this would be a great thing to just bring up is that a lot of times owners have concerns about pets and they come into the vet clinic and you've got a cat that limps at home but doesn't want to limp because it doesn't want to move in the exam room or maybe is scared and won't purr in the exam room. Taking a video, I've had lots of people come in with just like videos on their phone or whatever, so I can see what the pet's doing. So don't be afraid to do that. That sometimes is really helpful so we can actually see the problem that you're experiencing.
And speaking of limping, Annie emailed us. They just moved into a new house, and the 2-year-old cat's having a little trouble adjusting. Most recently, he has started to limp when walking and hold his front paws up when sitting. He's found a way to get onto the roof of our new house. Is it possible that his paws got scratched from the shingles, even though I didn't see any scratches? Alternatively, I have read that sometimes male cats develop faux limps with their environmental change.
Huh. I've not heard of that, but definitely, you know, be looking for some sort of trauma. My own cat back, this was a couple of years ago, I have a wood stove in my house. And, you know, in the summer, she was, you know, moving around and jumping and everything, and it was never a problem. And first time I lit it up in the winter, now she's smart. But this was a new cat that I just brought in, and she burned her feet pretty badly, and I felt very, very badly about it. So I would guess that it's possible that your cat would have had The opportunity went up on the roof, especially if the shingles are black or hot or really rough, causing some irritation. The fact that your cat is going outside looking for other things, like did he get into a fight and get irritated with, does he have an abscess brewing or something that could make him limp and not want to use his leg? I don't know if your cat is declawed or not. Hopefully not, if you're letting him outdoors. But sometimes we'll see cats, sometimes long time after declawing, start to regrow claws, and that can cause a limping as well. And since it's both front feet, that's why I kind of narrowed into maybe this cat was declawed and is having some post-operative problems if he's got some regrowth, if not all the nail-producing tissue was removed. So time to go into your veterinarian and have this looked at.
Let's go to Marla in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling about my 18-month-old dog who is having troubles eating out of his bowl. It seems like he's afraid of it. I have another dog as well. I'm not sure if it's connected to her behavior or his own behavior, but he won't eat. He wants to eat. He looks at the bowl and he stares longingly at it, but he won't eat until I dump the food out.
Okay. I've seen several dogs have this as a problem, and I don't know what the trigger is, but it's obviously some type of a phobia, whether his tags on his collar hit the bowl, whether, it makes noise when he eats that scares him, whether something bad happened, loud noise happened, something fell while he was eating. And so now it's like, when my head's in the bowl, something bad's going to happen. If he's at all, socially not at ease with the other dog being around and thinking that, if I put my head in the bowl, is she going to jump on me or try to steal my food? There's lots of different things that could be considered that way. Maybe if the bowl is too deep and he can't see what's approaching and he's a little jumpy, that may be part of it as well. So instead of using a bowl, maybe consider feeding him on a cookie sheet or something like a jelly roll pan or something that he can just eat on. A lot of times we never do find out what the reason is, but be looking at changing to, different depths of bowls, different materials rather than metal, maybe plastic, and seeing if that makes a difference as well. But if that's what he likes, eating it just dumped out of a bowl, don't force the issue and maybe just try to modify what you feed him on by using a cookie sheet.
Okay, great. That's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Cookie sheet can work.
Yep.
Let's go to Elaine in Pewaukee. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I have a Pomeranian that we rescued 3 years ago, and we have had Pomeranians in the past and have another one, too. This one, she is the most hyper dog I have ever seen. She is constantly fidgeting. She very rarely will sit still. The biggest problem we have, though, is any animal on TV, or I should say not just animal, bugs or anything with four legs, she just barks and barks at the TV. It's become a problem.
Okay.
And also she seems to be very afraid of men.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure what all happened to her in her early life. We think she's about 5 years old.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you have any advice.
Well, you've got lots of issues here. First of all, the fear of men, yes. I mean, who knows what's happened to her? A lot of people say, maybe she was abused. But in most cases, it's just kind of lack of exposure. If she was living maybe just with a woman or was a kennel dog that, never had a lot of exposure to other people, she may just be fearful of them because it's the unknown. Try to find maybe, a guy with long hair or that's more petite than your average, man that could, get her more comfortable and expose her to the least fearful type of guy that you can. And gradually she may get better over time if you make exposure to the thing that she's afraid of a pleasant experience for her. So, giving her treats and so on. Regarding the fidgeting and the barking, that may just be her. I mean, she just may be a little more of a hyper dog. Just, not all Poms are created equal just because they look alike.
Right.
They may have different personalities.
Right.
Look at harnessing some of that energy into maybe look into obedience work, dog agility, which even miniature dogs can participate in, giving her something to do, giving her a job so that, she's just not fidgeting and getting into trouble at home. I always think that, training is is the, one of the best things you can do, because if you've got a dog that has learned how to do a good sit, when the TV is on, it's hard to get a good bark out when your fanny's on the ground. And so that can be part of your, you know, retraining regarding the television set too. But that can be a difficult thing. I mean, I could talk to your veterinarian about perhaps using something like a citronella bark collar, which is not going to solve the problem of her being interested in the TV set, but it may just be enough to make her not want to bark. And be careful about your behavior too, because what I'll see owners do is they've got a dog that barks, they'll start yelling at the dog to shut up. Right. I want to watch TV. Right. And so, you know, the dog learns that, you know, there's another dog or a bird or whatever on TV, and, you know, I bark, the owner barks, everybody's barking. This is really something to be excited about. So trying to remain calm, cool, and collected yourself is going to be important too.
It's just amazing how she can pick them out of a crowd too.
Yeah. Very observant dog, so.
Thanks for calling, Elaine. Appreciate it. And here's another Elaine in Ashland. We'll go to you now. Hi.
Hi. I have a 10-year-old golden retriever that's been treated twice for Lyme disease, a 6-week round of doxycycline a year apart. And they've used the newer test, which is supposed to be a little more reliable or specific. I'm not sure which. And I want to know how I know if he's actually eradicated the infection.
Well, I'm not sure which test they're using, but there is one that is done by the IDEX company that's called one. Yeah, it's called a C6 quantitative antibody level. So what I do in my practice is when we do the screening test, which is just a little snap test that says yes or no, whether the pet's been exposed, that's testing for this antibody called a C6 antibody. It is an antibody that is presented, that the dog makes in response to the real bug, not the vaccine that could be introduced. So there isn't a cross reaction there. If we get a positive back, then we follow up with a blood test. And this is can be a little controversial, and it's something that, you know, we still haven't got the jury hasn't been, you know, pronounced verdict yet as to whether this is something that is totally trustworthy or not, but it's the best we have at this point. Is if the number that we get back on this test is elevated, and they've got a cutoff number, this company, at 30. Anything 30 and above, especially if it's accompanied with clinical signs such as lameness or swelling of joints or fever or whatever, requires treatment. And when I've had dogs that are really, I mean, truly sick with Lyme disease, they're usually in the hundreds. And so, you know, when I get that kind of below 100 and the dog isn't sick, treatment I kind of leave up to the owner. If the value is less than 30, asymptomatic, we typically don't treat. The nice thing about this antibody level is that it does drop in response to therapy. And so I recommend that owners, after we've gone through the treatment with doxycycline, come back in about 6 months later and recheck the value. It's going to be a little expensive because this test is not cheap, but by rechecking 6 months later, you would be able to see at least a 50% chance, a 50% drop in that level or greater if treatment has been successful. And so once your dog has been infected, they're always going to test positive. And so that's why it's really important to do that follow-up so that next year, when your dog tests positive again and you redo the number again, you can say, well, no, this was like the same as it was last year. It's, you know, not changing at all, so we don't have to worry about it. Or, whoops, the value's a lot higher. Maybe your dog's been re-exposed to a Ixodes tick and picked up Lyme, the Lyme bug again. So once you're positive, it becomes kind of a testing nightmare, and be prepared to be dropping a couple $100 every year.
The vaccine is no good after he's already had the disease.
No, past exposure does not impart future protection. You do need, when we have a dog that tests positive, it's imperative that they be vaccinated because they're obviously being in a spot where they're being exposed. So get your dog vaccinated.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Carl in Greene County, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you a question. Is it something that you could recommend as a book on puppy or dog training? This seems all divided about food reward or behavioral reward based.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of different training methods out there. And I think the big thing that I have to recommend is that you, you know, use positive reinforcement. You don't want to be making this kind of like, all totally punishment. And, you know, some of the controversy regarding some of the, big names on TV, I don't want to name names, but, he's the he whispers to dogs. OK, I'll just put it that way. He's been poo-pooed by the American Veterinary Medical Association. There is a group of veterinarian specialists in behavior called the American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior, and they have come out with different position statements regarding, harsh methods of training. And so, food rewards, I think, works. If the dog is food motivated, works great. I'll give you an example of a case that I had in recently. I had an owner in with their Labrador Retriever puppy. It was a husband and wife and their teenage son, and the wife said, I am not going to use food. I don't want to have this dog have food as a reward for going to the bathroom outside for housebreaking, which the dog was in the process of being trained. So I turned to the mom and I said, well, what did you do for your son when he went to the bathroom in the potty? And she said, oh, I gave him M&Ms. And I kind of was like, well, you gave food to your son. What's so different about doing it with your dog? So then I turned to the son and I said, does your mom stand outside the bathroom now and still hand out M&Ms to you because you've gone to the bathroom? And he says, I didn't even know she did that. And I said, there you go. You drove the point home for your son when he was young by giving him M&Ms, and it became a self-rewarding behavior, and he continued on with it. Same thing works for dogs. You're not going to be hooked into always having to give food. It becomes a behavior that the dog does just for attention, and you don't necessarily have to persistently stay with food rewards.
And you can actually, Patricia McConnell has got a nice book out. It's called The Puppy Primer.
Yes, excellent book. Yep, and I think there's another one on the family dog or
right.
Something like that too. But The Puppy Primer or Primer is a great little book to use. So that would be one I'd recommend.
All right. Let's thank you again for calling, Carl. Jason in Lockport, Illinois. On to you. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a cat that's probably, maybe about 13, 14 years old. And last year we just purchased like a Labrador dog, which is about a year old. And now the cat is always hiding, and she's going to the bathroom like behind the couch now.
Okay.
And she's vomiting all the time. Like she doesn't use a litter box. I was wondering, do you think she's afraid of the dog or she just has something internal wrong with her?
Well, it sounds like a combination of the two. For a cat that would just be afraid of the dog, yes, hiding behind places, being afraid to go to the litter box because they're going to be chased, could cause a cat to be inappropriately eliminating. That would not be causing a cat to vomit. And so with the vomiting and the change in behavior, it's time to take your kitty in for a good senior evaluation and perhaps have some urine checked and lab work checked to see if there's anything medically wrong with your cat. But, back to the behavior issues, whenever we have a cat that is in a situation where maybe access to the litter box may be blocked by the dog. I had a client in not too long ago that had adopted a Rottweiler puppy, and they kept the litter box, one litter box, in the laundry room, which is also where the puppy stayed in his crate during the day when they were gone. And the cat started urinating and defecating in the living room because it didn't want to go into the room where the puppy was. So, be looking at giving the cat multiple litter box choices in areas where it doesn't have to tiptoe past the dog to be able to get to them. So not down in the basement, preferably one on every floor of the house where the cat can see if the dog is coming. So you may even need to be looking at a litter box. I know it sounds a little disgusting in your living room. I'd rather have them go there than, behind the sofa as well. But do get your cat in to have him checked out.
All right. Thank you for calling. Sharon in Brown Lake, Illinois. On to you.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I heard you talk about the
fatty tumors?
Yeah, the fatty tumors.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, they seem to be popping up here and there, and that's part of that process or that issue, right?
And it's not that it's a tumor that's spreading. It's just the dog is genetically primed to get them. And some dogs will have one. Some dogs will get lots of them. We had a Doberman in a few months ago that had so many lipomas, and two of them were right on the front of his chest, and they were huge. And when he sat down and his legs were together, he actually had cleavage.
Now the other part, though, is what are symptoms of it being a bigger issue?
Well,
I've got him. He's on a tablet that is partly for antihistamine and then partly for prednisone.
Okay.
Worse this year.
So he's on it for allergies. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because it itches.
Okay. Lipomas usually don't itch. They may get irritated if they're in a spot where they're constantly being rubbed, or like in an armpit, over the sternum, in areas. So if they're in a spot where it's very selective, we know that it's bothering the dog, then removal is indicated. But if your dog is being treated for allergies, I'm wondering if it's scratching because it's itchy for whatever reason, and the lipomas are just getting in the way. That's not the cause of the itch. Long-term steroid use does have complications for dogs. And the research on using antihistamines as a way of controlling itching in dogs is found to be really poorly effective. And even though we use them, I never tell an owner that this will be the end. I mean, we have to add in other drugs. So it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, does my dog have a secondary bacterial or yeast infection because of all the trauma he's causing? Is there anything else that we can use for his allergies, such as topical steroid sprays, which are going to be safer than oral steroids in the long run? Should we be looking at going on a cyclosporine-type drug like Atopica? Is there a diet change that we could use? Should we be doing allergy testing? I think it's, I'd be addressing it more from the allergy standpoint than the lipomas, because unless it's like one lipoma and that's the only thing that the dog itches, if that's it, then, by all means, take care of the lipoma.
Well, where it is, it's on his hind quarters, mostly on one on each side.
Mm-hmm.
And, he'll lay on his back and just keep moving around on it to get some kind of relief of some sort.
Yeah.
And he'll sit next to the couch and lift up his hind legs and scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of,
I really doubt that it's the lipomas. My guess is that it's and make sure that they are lipomas, because it could be another type of tumor that can be more irritating.
Well, if it is a more serious tumor, is that what kind of occurs with them?
No. You make sure that your veterinarian has done a biopsy, a needle biopsy, to confirm that it is a lipoma.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Sally in Wayland, Minnesota, hi to you.
Hi, you guys. I'm glad we had time for my call. I have some farm kittens. They're all very fat, very healthy, very friendly. But they all had stuck eyes when they were little, and they've all cleared off. All their eyes have pretty much cleared off except one. And this morning, his eye is really stuck.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that you can help me. You can suggest a home remedy for me to clean his eyes out with, please.
Yeah, well, most of these cases are usually viral. Typically, herpes is the condition that causes this in cats. And the big issue is that with persistent herpes, sometimes you can have cases of corneal ulceration. And I have seen kittens actually lose their eyeballs from this, too, where the cornea ruptures. So a home remedy is going to be really difficult for me to recommend, just due to the fact that you may have something more serious going on. Typically, if there isn't an ulcer after, even though there are antiviral drugs and things that you can use for the eye, most of these cats will also develop secondary bacterial infections and need to have some type of a topical antibiotic given as well. So, besides keeping the eye area clean with warm compresses and things, I really think that you may want to be thinking about getting this kitty into a veterinarian to have that eye checked out.
Okay. And with that, thank you, Sally. With that, we have to close. Sandy, thank you very much.
Oh, it went fast.
I have you down for returning on September 21st.
That would work for me.
All right, Tuesday, September 21st. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, will be back and we'll do this all over again with her. Tomorrow, I talk with Buckshot Anderson, Northwoods fishing guide, about his latest book. And then Bob Birmingham comes by to talk about his latest book on effigy mounds. Stay with us.